Did you know the U.S. has a surplus in services with the rest of the world worth $269 billion? America's economy has changed drastically, and so has its trade relationships. There's a lot we can learn if we look a bit closer, and that's why we need a more nuanced, productive conversation on global trade. As America evolves and the global trade picture becomes more complicated, we are revisiting the debate over the topic. We'll have a special branded episode of Global Translations on June 27th, brought to you by Citi. Stay tuned wherever you subscribe to this podcast.
We all have that person in our life that we know is really bad for us, but is kind of a lot of fun to spend time with. And you can't help but making that phone call every once in a while or whatever, and starting that relationship over again. To me, that's China.
We are in a pivotal moment, perhaps a once-in-a-generation moment, where the U.S. is attempting a great rebalancing of its relationship with China and, frankly, its role in the world.
This morning, he is doubling down in a tweet.
We have to be damn fools if we don't think we haven't been in a trade war for decades.
Don't call the leaders of other countries names.
We're the piggy bank that they like to take from.
We literally are living sort of tweet to tweet.
And if you're distracted by some crazy tweets and the shouting on cable news, you might be missing it. Why are we fighting this trade war? And one of the best answers I've heard comes from Dan Yutso.
I'm Dan Yutso. I'm an international trade and customs attorney with Dickinson Wright.
He's an Ohio guy, born and bred.
I'm a trade guy, but I grew up in northeastern Ohio.
He's mostly focused on NAFTA and North American issues.
Where I grew up, NAFTA is not a four-letter word, but if you say the word NAFTA, you're going to hear a four-letter word come flying back at you.
But lately, a lot of my conversations with Dan end up leading to China. Recently, he was in a meeting with some very senior people from the business community representing sectors that were highly impacted on trade, and the business people came in and they did a very slick presentation.
PowerPoint, graphics, the whole thing that said, if you do this, administration, if you do what you're talking about doing on trade, if you do that,
the economic gains from the Trump tax cuts, from the Trump deregulation, the historically low unemployment rate, the high rate of growth, the strong stock market gains, all of that will be overwhelmed by the negative impacts of this trade war.
And the representatives of the administration looked at it, and then everybody thought it was a mic drop moment, right? Aha. And everybody in the administration kind of looked at each other and said, we know. You think we don't know that? But let's look. We've had this issue with China since the early 2000s. We're not able to do anything in the first decade of this century because we were in the middle of the war on terror, right? It was all about 9/11, Afghanistan, Iraq. Then we went into the Great Recession, and we certainly couldn't have done anything then that would cause any shocks. And in fact, for most of this decade, we've been in recovery mode. Now, all of the economists are telling us we're looking at a recession just on business cycles, probably in 2020, 21, maybe, who knows when, but coming soon. And China's talking about Made in China 2025. If we don't do this now, when will we ever do this? So it's really, I think, in the eyes of this administration, a now or never moment. And they may be right.
This idea that now is the time to fundamentally change the U.S. relationship with China, it really struck me, and that's what this show is about. Big problems that need big solutions that will require much more creativity than our politicians and our policymakers can often muster in an increasingly interconnected and complicated world. From Politico, this is Global Translations. I'm Louisa Savage. I've got Politico's chief economic correspondent, Ben White, with me. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Louisa.
And Ben, let's start by going back in time to what we sometimes call the end of history. That moment when, I don't know where you were at the end of history, but I was in college and we were watching some incredible things go on around the world. We were seeing the end of the Cold War.
I say, let's renew our pledge and build a more peaceful world.
we were seeing the Berlin Wall coming down.
Just a short while ago, astonishing news from East Germany, where the East German authorities have said, in essence, that the Berlin Wall doesn't mean anything anymore. The wall
that the we were seeing countries that were once authoritarian and communist embrace democracy, embrace capitalism. And for me, someone who was born in Eastern Europe, this was an incredibly euphoric time. And it seemed like the march of history was toward democracy and capitalism. How did it look from where you sat?
Well, from where I sat, I was listening to a lot of Pearl Jam and Nirvana in college, but was in fact also paying attention to what seemed like, you know, a big shift in the march of globalism and free trade. Now, there were plenty of critics of all of this who didn't love this march toward globalization, but it did seem to be the wave of the future. Free trade, walls coming down, nations trading with one another to lift everybody out of poverty. And that was going to lead to liberalization of democracies around the world, particularly in China. That was the future of the global economy. And there are a lot of really interesting players from this era. And I talked to one of the big ones.
Hello, is this Ben White?
Carla Hills.
Are you posing the questions or am I holding forth with a speech?
She was the U.S. trade representative under President George Herbert Walker Bush. And what the USTR does is essentially serve as the lead trade negotiator for the United States, is the main person in all the big meetings for the creation of trade deals.
I'm honored to appear before you today as the nominee for U.S. trade representative.
There's a great moment where George Bush gives her this giant crowbar, which was, you know, kind of a joke, basically saying, Carla, take this crowbar and go pry open these new markets for us.
Pry them open. You know, I would like to have you think of me as the USTR with a crowbar, where we're prying open markets, keeping them open so that our private sector...
And it worked. The U.S. led the way in creating a rule book for global free trade. So you had some really important things happen during this period of time in the 1990s. Creation of the European Union in 1993, passage of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, in 1994.
Bush picked an appropriately symbolic setting today to sign the North American...
And the creation of the World Trade Organization in 1995.
Meeting offers WTO members a chance to renew their faith in global trade liberalization.
So there was a widespread idea that the world was moving towards a period of globalization and free trade and the bringing down of barriers, and that nothing could stop that.
It was optimistic, but I think appropriate for the time. We clearly benefited from opening the markets. President Bush Sr. Actively believed that we could not, in this interconnected world, accomplish our goals without having a collaboration with other nations. It was a history that was continuing to progress.
So, Louisa, essentially what the free traders say is that the way to lift nations out of poverty and to create more wealth is to do more trade.
I don't think we could survive as well by turning inward. We have 5% of the world's population producing nearly 20% of its output. We need markets beyond our borders. And if you look at the benefits that we have achieved by opening markets, it's not just the economic that I allude to of the $2 trillion in additional GDP and the fact that our allies gained and we climbed out of a really ugly hole following World War II, but also poor nations gained. And the richer the poor countries get, the more likely you are that they will not become havens for international crime and terrorism. So there are a lot of benefits that flow from opening markets and creating collaborative neighbors and colleagues around the world.
And Ben, wouldn't you say there was also this theory that the more we democracies engage with other countries that maybe aren't democracies themselves, the more we'll win them over, the more they'll start to share our values and do things the way we do them, and it will be this positive cycle towards democratization and human rights and, you know, capitalist trade.
Yeah, this is absolutely kind of the foundational argument by the free traders that it would do that, that, you know, more free trade and lowering of barriers would encourage nations to develop towards the liberal democratic model.
So one of the selling points of more open trade is that free trade is a win-win proposition.
Yeah, so I talked about that with Mike Froman, another former U.S. trade rep. He served under President Barack Obama.
The degree of poverty alleviation we've seen in the last 75 years has no historic precedent. There's been a greater impact, positive impact, on people's lives in the last 75 years than any time in human history. But those countries or regions that failed to open up, failed to pursue good, strong macroeconomic policies, did not see the same degree of benefit. And so we have a pretty good case study, a comparative case study of those countries that did pursue globalization and those that didn't. And that very much affected my perspective.
All right. So you have big idea number one, that free trade can make everybody better off. Big idea number two is that if you're going to have free trade, you need some rules that everybody agrees to live by. You take those two rules together and you get a pretty good sense for what was unfolding in the 1990s and through the early 2000s.
So here's where we were in history. Democracy is ascendant. Capitalism is ascendant. You have countries coming together to create a rules-based system that they could all rely upon. But all that was based on the assumption, the hope, that other countries, especially China, would play by the rules. And not just play by the rules, but that being a part of a rules-based trading system with major democratic capitalist nations, that other countries would move toward capitalism inch by inch, and that there would be a move toward more openness politically and with regard to human rights and dissent. But that future, it just didn't pan out the way we thought.
Pretty much everyone we talked to agreed China doesn't play by the rules of international trade.
I voted for China to be in the WTO, and they haven't lived up to the rules of international trade.
The military is the government, is the economy, is the government.
China is falling short of complying with quite a few of its WTO obligations.
Whether it's stealing of intellectual property rights.
China's overproduction of steel is a plague. Is a plague.
Whether it's currency manipulation. They have so woefully and blatantly violated all norms of international trade.
We really haven't dealt with a state-owned socialist communist country of this size before.
And when they're talking about China as a bad actor, they usually mean that it's the Chinese who are flooding the market with cheap goods, the Chinese government is subsidizing all of these industries. And whenever any American company wants to go and do business in China, they force them to turn over their technology. That just means if you're a tech company and you go to do business in China, you have to take all of this proprietary intellectual property and give it to the Chinese. And obviously, American companies do not like to do that. So there's basically no disagreement that there is a big problem going on here with China, but there's huge disagreement over what we do about it. Do we just slap unilateral tariffs on China and engage in a trade war? Do we put together a coalition of other countries to pressure China? Or do we just go to the WTO? Obviously, the Trump administration has decided to take on China one-on-one with a unilateral trade war, and our allies are just waiting around to see how it goes. I talked with Christine McDaniel, who's a trade economist and senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center.
You can see this in the data. The state-owned enterprise share of their economy started to shrink after they joined the WTO. And then after President Xi took much stronger control of everything, now that's reversed course. And now we see a really increased presence of state-owned enterprise in China's economy. And those expectations we had have not been realized yet. And it doesn't seem like they're going to anytime soon with the current political situation in China. It's not realistic to think they are going to give up state capitalism in order to escape some tariffs from the United States.
What happens next? More in a moment.
Global trade is complicated, but it's often discussed in a simplistic way. America is up, it's down, it's winning, it's losing. The U.S. economy looks much different than it did 30 years ago. So why hasn't our understanding of global trade changed with it?
We don't even have a common definition of what trade is today. And in fact, you know, when we look at the U.S. actually runs a trade surplus when it comes to the services component of what it does.
Yes, a surplus.
People get a little bit wide-eyed when you actually tell them that far and away the most dominant contributor to jobs or the economy or economic growth is, in fact, the services component. There's a bit of surprise there.
We'd find a lot of surprising nuances to trade if we just looked a little bit closer. I'm Carol Zimmer. Stay tuned for an upcoming special branded episode of Global Translations, brought to you by our sponsor, Citi. We will be revisiting our understanding of global trade. We'll hear from two executives of global companies who are riding the shift to services in the U.S. economy and the global economy, the CEO of Citi and the CEO of AT&T. Stay tuned for the final trade episode of Global Translations on June 27th.
Ben, let's talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What is it?
All right, so the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which everybody calls TPP, was a giant trade deal, 12 nations around the Pacific Rim, led by the United States and Japan as the biggest economies in it, but not China. But China was absolutely the top of everybody's mind when TPP was being debated and created.
When TPP was announced, the reaction from China was not very positive, that this is an anti-China measure.
Darcy Vedder was a negotiator at the U.S. Trade Rep's office for President Obama, and this is her take.
The more TPP went forward, if you know, China's response would be to say, if this model is successful, if it becomes a strong alliance, if other countries do see it as attractive, it was always meant to be a magnet to bring others into the region, then that's actually an alliance we would think about joining. The idea that it was designed necessarily to contain China, I'm not sure that that's the right word, or that's not really the way I thought about it. It was more to sort of influence China to create a set of practices.
If you think about the trade agreements that the U.S. was a party to, they were pretty old. And part of the promise of TPP was supposed to be the things that either weren't included in NAFTA because they didn't exist, or to fix some of the things that were wrong or weren't good enough or strong enough. And the idea was to set rules of the road that China would eventually feel compelled to follow.
You know, I would always say the most important export from TPP will be the U.S. way of doing business.
So this sounds like a logical plan, like a way to get a big part of the world to give U.S. companies certainty and help them make rational decisions about where to put their investment, to reduce risks of investing abroad, to encourage trade, to bring more countries into the trading fold. Sounds like it makes sense.
It did make a lot of sense, but politics happened. It was a tough sell in an election year in places in the Midwest where Dan Yuzzo lives and works.
We did more on the ground roundtables with businesses and stakeholder groups in Ohio and Michigan and Western New York for TPP than I could count.
Darcy Vedder was actually one of the ones out there trying to sell it in those roundtables.
You know, I spent much of 2016 going to all the small cities in the U.S. talking about TPP.
Now, how many Americans actually understood that the TPP was not a trade deal with China? That's subject to debate. And I just will go to my grave saying we didn't have the votes to get that through Congress because people didn't understand it.
You know, shame on us a little bit for not understanding the depth of anxiety about how quickly the global economy seemed to be leaving broad parts of the United States behind. And for not thinking about how we talk about trade and its opportunities, for not investing equally in advancing our workforce to meet the needs of a global economy at the same time that we were advancing these trade relationships. Those are not mutually exclusive goals, but it was easy to present them as such. We had one part of the economy that had no idea how their interests were being represented by the trade agenda. And, you know, I think Trump capitalized on that anger in a way that was really masterful.
So that's where we are right now.
I immediately withdrew the United States from the horrible, disastrous, would have been another NAFTA but worse, Trans-Pacific Partnership.
All right, so let's just quickly recap some of the things that President Donald Trump has done to completely upset the order of things when it comes to trade. He imposed steel and aluminum tariffs on allies like Europe and Canada. He threatened to pull out of NAFTA in 2017, then threatened to scrap it if Congress doesn't pass the new NAFTA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. And of all the stuff the president has done on trade, pulling out of TPP is the one that really drives people like former U.S. trade rep Mike Froman completely bonkers.
We have lost by pulling out of TPP, which I have repeatedly said I think is perhaps the most significant strategic blunder in recent American history, we've lost that position for the United States, at least for now. And we have created a void, a vacuum, that China is quite effectively filling at the moment.
He said, I'm going to go it alone on China, and I'm going to do it myself. My administration is going to fight China one-on-one. We're not going to be part of this trading block of 12 countries and a giant part of the global economy that would take on China in a multilateral way.
That reminds me of something that Michael Pillsbury said when I spoke with him. Michael Pillsbury is an advisor to President Trump on trade and China, and he's been advising successive U.S. presidents on China going back to Richard Nixon.
Well, the TPP was a good idea because it was a test to see if without China, could 10 or a dozen Asian countries all agree to high standards for labor and environmental protection, but also try to reduce tariffs among themselves. And the Obama administration demonstrated, yes, it can be done. But during the campaign, President Trump's dream, if you will, is that multilateral organizations have to reach kind of the lowest common denominator. So an even better deal with lower tariffs and other parts of the trade deals can be done if it's bilateral. That's something he ran on. And the economists don't like it, but the politicians tend to say, yeah, you probably can't, if you're the most powerful country, you probably can get a better deal in bilateral agreements. But the problem is it takes so long to negotiate each one. Whereas something like the TPP, you immediately have all 12 countries wrapped up. And as I was a consultant to the Obama administration in the Pentagon, and I think one of their concepts was, after we get TPP done, then we show China, you can join, but you've got to meet all these standards. And we'll never know whether China would have said yes or no.
So I was really interested to talk to Michael Pillsbury because he's had such a big influence on this administration and the way they think about China and the way that they think about trade. He's someone who talks to Robert Lighthizer, the USTR. He's someone who influences the conversation in Washington around China. And he's someone who's been thinking about these issues for a really long time.
So I learned Mandarin Chinese, Wo Xing Bai, Ming Zijiao Bang Rei, and wrote my PhD dissertation on China.
And his story is so interesting because he started out as someone who advocated for more openness between the United States and China.
And I was taught even more firmly that China was our future friend. We had mistreated China badly, that anyone who thought badly about China was a McCarthyite, who was anti-communist and therefore wrong.
And as time went on, he came to see China as more and more of a strategic threat, both economically and militarily.
Then I joined the government off and on for 30 years. And most of that time, I was also told China is America's natural ally. We need to sell weapons to China. We need to cooperate with China in covert action of the CIA. And the real enemy is the Soviet Union. So that was my basic bias from age 18, shall we say, up into the 1990s.
And then what happened?
Well, it didn't work out the way I was taught. It turned out that I and many others had deceived ourselves that China wanted to be just like us. So if we had massive trade with China and the middle class in China grew and we sold weapons to China to help them defend themselves, slowly over time, they would become a capitalist free market country. They would have some kind of democratic, at least respect for human rights, if not a multi-party election system. And they would certainly be America's best friend in the world. When that didn't happen, different people had different moments when they woke up.
And his book, The 100-Year Marathon, has had a lot of influence in Washington and among people in the Trump administration who really see trade as just one piece of the bigger emerging rivalry with China for superpower status. Do you think that the institutions that were built in the 90s were built on premises that are not true, assumptions about China that are not true, and therefore it's time to kind of reform those rules?
We're in a period now where the answer is going to become clear to your question. I would say over the next year or two, we're going to find out, can we have a trade deal? Can we have some kind of reconciliation with China? Can we get back to the G2 cooperative spirit? In which case, the institutions that have been built are all perfect for a U.S.-China cooperative relationship. Or are we moving in a very different direction from G2? Are we moving toward a new Cold War, a relationship in which competition and friction far outweighs whatever cooperation is possible? And will our various allies in Europe and in Asia have to take sides, which they don't want to do? They're very happy to trade and get along with China and with the United States. But if it goes more toward a new Cold War relationship, then the allies will be put on the spot as well. But it's too soon to say in 2019 which of these grand directions we're moving in. In fact, just in the recent past, it's become even more possible to see both of these alternatives, but not to know which one is coming.
In this current trade dispute between the United States and China with the ratcheting up of tariffs, who has more leverage?
Nobody knows, at least I don't know. There's a case for each side. Our leverage may be on their economy and on their political system, that we will, if their economy starts to suffer and the growth rate drops from 6.5 down to 6% or even below because of the tariffs, then it's going to enhance this debate in Beijing. If the reformers win, then we will get a deal and we'll look back and say, aha, we had more leverage. But right now it's very hard to tell. You can't make microeconomic quantitative calculations of relative pain very accurately. So it's a bit of a mystery.
So Ben, this feels like a really big deal. It feels like we're actually in a transition moment. You just see it again and again, China, China, China. What do you think?
So I think what you see, if you pull back the lens here and step away from the daily tweets and all of the noise, is that we are very much on a pivot point of history in terms of the United States' relationship with China, the second largest economy in the world, and that everything that the Trump administration is doing on trade with the renegotiation of NAFTA and junking TPP and the steel and aluminum tariffs are all in service of this bigger, historic battle with the Chinese. And what you hear from Pillsbury, and it's common to other people, hawkish China trade people in the Trump administration, is that they had moments of radicalization on China over the last couple of decades, where they went from thinking that China will ultimately be our friend and will develop in this way that embraces democracy and capitalism and human rights, to thinking that they absolutely are not doing that, that they have a very different plan in mind, which could undermine the U.S. economy in many ways. And so they have set up their worldview and their policy to take on China. And now we're at this moment where we are in this fight. We're in the unilateral fight with China over the future of global trade and then trade between these two giant nations. And it could go in a number of directions. One, dawn of a new Cold War with China, in which we are in a long-term trade fight with them that will hurt, both the U.S. and China, and who will bend the knee first. Or Trump decides that he needs to make a deal with China, whether it's a sweeping one or a smaller one, and that we don't get engaged in this giant trade war. But, that this is all playing out in real time as you and I speak, this historic tectonic fight with the Chinese.
And I think, Ben, this is what we'll be exploring throughout this podcast series, is the implications of these big tectonic shifts. And the implications are quite staggering for allies. Do they pick sides? What are their interests in all of this? How do they respond? How is this war in the trade arena with China impacting America's ability to negotiate trade agreements elsewhere and impacting its broader relationships with historical allies? The implications for technology, for the global governance and multilateral approaches to the kinds of solutions that will be needed to tackle global problems like climate change. So next time on Global Translations, Ben and I are going to talk politics. Is there a political constituency for free trade? Where are the Democrats on this issue?
Well, I'm worried that the president has done it wrong. Tariffs are a temporary tool to get to a long-term trade policy, not tariffs as the policy itself.
And where are the Republicans headed in the age of Trump?
Whereas most presidents run on a platform, they don't stand on that platform. This president is standing on that platform.
Even if it wasn't a great platform?
He got elected on it. You expect people to keep their promises once they're elected.
Thanks to my colleague Ben White. Our producer is Annie Reese. We had help on this episode from Patricia Jacob and Micaela Rodriguez. Dave Shaw is the executive producer of Politico Audio. I'm Louisa Savage. Global Translations is presented by Citi, a leading global bank. Subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts and listen for a branded episode from Citi about some of these same themes coming Thursday, June 27th. Thanks, and see you next week.